Welcome to Two Way Street. I have to tell you, I love talking with Bruce Feiler. He's a man bursting with original ideas, so many that when you talk to him, sometimes two or three thoughts seem to emerge almost simultaneously, and you have to figure out which one to focus on at a given moment. And that's fine with me, because Bruce reinterprets ancient stories in a way that allows all of us to think more deeply about who we are today. He and I had never met before, but I do know Bruce's brother, Andrew, who lives here in Atlanta. So that may have given us a rapport that helped make the conversation flow more easily. But I suspect that's really just who Bruce is. A guy of enormous curiosity who likes talking with people about what he's been learning. You may know Bruce from any of his many New York Times best-selling books. Perhaps from Walking the Bible, which was turned into a popular PBS series that he hosted. For that project, he went on a 10,000-mile journey, walking the lands depicted in the five books of Moses. For his new book, The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us, Bruce went traveling again, across four continents, exploring the story of Adam and Eve and the impact they've had on history down through the ages. Bruce invites us to see their story through the literature of John Milton's Paradise Lost, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and the work of Mark Twain, among others. And he gives us a new interpretation of the magnificent paintings Michelangelo created in the Sistine Chapel. What Bruce found on his journey is that we really don't understand the story of Adam and Eve at all. Bruce Feiler, welcome to Two Way Street. It's really a pleasure to have you here to talk about the first love story, Adam, Eve, and Us.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
You, first of all, we should say, this book opens with a beautiful quote. Mm. You've pulled a quote from Thomas Merton, the great, great Catholic writer and theologian. "Love is our true destiny. We do not find the meaning of life by ourselves alone. We find it with another."
One of the startling, fascinating, ultimately to me very moving parts of working on this book was that I went in to write a book about Adam and Eve, and I ended up writing a book about love. And I didn't really know that was going to happen. You know, for me, my process begins at my kitchen table, right? So as you know, I live surrounded by women. I have a working wife who's a CEO in her own right. I have identical twin daughters who will soon be 12. And that means we spend a huge amount of time talking about that thing that we all talk about all the time, which is the changing way men and women relate to each other. We're in this time of tumultuous change from lean in to can we have it all to the end of men, whatever it might be. And the internet, of course, has made this all the more complicated. And I'm just confused and frustrated, and this is now kind of a work that's been 10 years in the making. My last two books were about this. I've written 100 New York Times columns about families in one way or the other. And most of the way we talk about this is to say, let's look at the latest research, right? Or some new efficiency app that can make us all relate better. And as someone who spent a lot of time in the ancient world, I can't help thinking there must be something from the past that's worth preserving. So the actual genesis is we're on a business trip to Rome. My wife has one. We tag along. And I have the brilliant idea on day one to take my sleep-deprived daughters to the Vatican. Right? This doesn't go well. Like, my feet hurt. This is boring. Why are there carpets on the ceiling?
How old were your daughters?
They were about eight at the time. Okay. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll get them to the Sistine Chapel for sure. That'll blow their mind. We go in. We look up. Girls, look! And one of them looks at that image of God and Adam sailing across the sky and says, well, that's only men. Where am I in that picture? And her sisters, my mom in Savannah is an art teacher and an art historian, and she saw something I'd never seen before, this woman under God's arm. And she says, wait a minute, is that Eve? And that's when I realized, Bill, is that this story has been at the heart of every conversation about men, women, and God for 3,000 years. And as absurd as it sounds, maybe it has something to teach us. Okay, so I set off on this journey with the idea, can the first relationship tell us something about relationships today? Well, what I want to say is that what happens in this process of looking through this story and going on this sort of, I think of as the ultimate Adam and Eve road trip to the Garden of Eden in Iraq and Jerusalem and Rome and London and Hollywood and the
Capitol. You're always looking for excuses to travel.
Well, exactly. My process, I grew up in Georgia, so I've been looking for excuses to leave and come back my whole life. Right. That's my whole, I just did my career for you in 9 seconds. But what I found was this fascinating dialogue between the past and the present. So let's just talk about this. Positive psychology. What's the number one thing we've learned about positive psychology? Relationships are central to our well-being. The famous Grant study, as you know, the Harvard Men, 75 years. Happiness is love, full stop. What's the greatest threat to happiness is loneliness. I think of it, loneliness, as the great kind of social health crisis that we have. Young people feeling lonelier, middle-aged men in particular, the opioid crisis, the suicide crisis, old people feeling lonely. So loneliness is a threat. What's the first thing God says about human beings in the Bible after looking at Adam? It's not right for humans to be alone. So I think that that is really what this story is about. I think that Merton quote gets at it, which is it's fundamentally Adam and Eve are the first to wrestle, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, with the central mystery of being alive, which is being unalone.
So I want to ask you about something. This may be getting too deep in the weeds.
Please.
We always hear Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Your title is Adam, Eve, and Us. But what you've done essentially is, by separating them with a comma, told us they're two unique individuals. You've taken out the and, because although there is an and, one of the things you want us to understand in your book is that they are two unique individuals, and that's the only thing that allows them to eventually really learn how to love one another. The and is us. We're the and in your title. Have I gone too far into the weeds on this, Bruce?
First of all, it's not weeds, it's words. And words matter, you know, when you're in a word business. And I kind of crazy love this question. And I can guarantee you, whatever I say now, I'm going to think about now for the next 2 weeks. My main thing is, I want you to take what's familiar and reimagine it. And so the main thing that we were trying to do by taking out the and is make you think twice. Okay? That's why this book is modern with clean type. I said to them, whatever you do with this cover, I'm open. You guys are the art directors, but don't give me medieval art. Don't give me some picture out of the Middle Ages. Sure enough, they sent me a cover with medieval art. And I'm like, no, it's got to be new and fresh. And they came back with this, with the two leaves on the bottom. It's clean. And this subtitle. And so I think, yes, it makes you rethink something that you think that you know.
Absolutely.
I think the and is important in the sense that Adam and Eve are the first we. If I think of any other biblical figure, Abraham, Noah, David, Solomon, Moses, Jesus, Paul, whatever, even the ones that have spouses, we think of them as singles. Adam and Eve are the only ones that we think of as a couple, right? They're the first joint byline. So I do think that the and is important. But in this case, I think the and connecting us to them is even more important.
You tell us that the deep-seated human need for connectedness is the theme, maybe even the dominant theme, that runs throughout the story of Adam and Eve from the very beginning, when God recognized, as you've already said, it is not good for man to be alone. But here's what I find interesting about that, Bruce. God was alone. Mm. How did it occur to God that the human that he created, Adam, needed a partner when he himself lives alone for eternity?
So, okay, let's remember that's a breakthrough, right? So it's a breakthrough that the human God is alone. And you could read the story of the book of Genesis of God looking for a partner, right? So God forms Adam and Eve, and that in some ways is disappointing to God. God forms Noah. Noah saves the world, and then Noah gets drunk. And, you know, and the whole theme of my book, Abraham, A Journey to the Heart of Three Faiths, is that God then finds this partnership in Abraham, because Abraham himself is old with Sarah, but unable to have children, and they need each other. So I think that God is looking for a partnership in human beings from the very beginning. But what's really interesting, since you're into weeds and words that's going to be our new show. When we have a joint podcast, it'll be Weeds and Words.
I guess
I'll be the weeds and you'll be the words, because you've accused me of being the weed guy here. Let me just take a step back and say, one of the things you discover when you write a book about Adam and Eve is there's not one story, there's two. The second story is the more famous of Adam and Eve, and that's Adam being formed from the earth. Right, exactly. That's Eve being formed from his part of his body. It's not the rib. We can get into that. Eve eating the fruit. It's not an apple. We can get into that. Being kicked out from Eden, and as we said, staying together, have the children, and on down the road. The first story, though, that story appears to be about who's God's chosen sex, male or female. And that's the way the story was mostly talked about for the first 3,000 years. But the first story makes it very different. In the first story, in the sixth day, God says, let's create a human creation. So you've got the animals, Okay, and then God creates this ungendered human being and then divides it into two. So what's true for the male is true for the female. And in this time of gender fluidity and gender beyond the binary, it's fascinating to see this idea here that we all kind of carry male and female around within us. And then we move to the second story, God creates the animals. And then God creates Adam, and Adam doesn't have a partner. So Adam is looking at all the animals.
Now, you point out God sort of parades all animals he's created. It's sort of like a beauty pageant for Adam. Right, exactly. How about this one? What about that one?
And I think of it as this ultimate Tinder moment. Swipe left, swipe left. I don't want to be with the hippopotamus. I don't want to be with the giraffe. I don't want to be with the rooster. And that's when he kind of looks longingly to God and is like, hell, I need somebody here. And God says it's not right for humans to be alone. And then we have the ultimate meet cute in Hollywood, right? He falls asleep and he wakes up and there's a woman and he's ecstatic. And everyone who says by the way, it's not the rib. Since I teased it, I'll say it's the side, tselah in Hebrew. That's the part of the body that Eve is created from. The rib was just put in by the commentators because ribs are small and insignificant and given to putrefaction, the rabbi said. That's not accurate. It's the side. They stand side by side.
But you also tell us, in as long as you're at that moment, you talk about the various parts that, is it the rabbis who talked about? He did not create Eve from the hand. Remind me of what that's all
well,
about.
Well, it's a great, I mean, I'm almost inclined to open the book and try to find, like, yeah, not from the hand so they can do this, not from the brain, not from, it's like they went through all of the parts that would make her equal and important and relevant to pick, because she's from the rib, because that's just insignificant. I mean, this is in some ways the antagonist, like if the protagonists of this book are Adam and Eve, the antagonists are essentially the voices of organized religion who are weaponizing the story to elevate men and keep women down. And the way it was, I was like, oh, Adam is created from the earth, and the earth is everywhere, and you leave earth out for 3 days, nothing happens. But a rib is small and insignificant. You leave a rib out for 3 days, it starts to smell.
It begins to smell.
Yeah, because, like, that's what women do. I mean, Eve has been victim of the greatest character assassination the world has ever known. And I think that, you know, why this matters, I mean, this would just be interesting, but I think why it matters is at this moment where we're trying to define how men and women relate to each other, at the moment when religion, in effect, has become voluntary, who could blame women for running the other way? They have stuck around, rewritten, and reclaimed this story so that today, men and women, who can deny that men and women stand equally before God? And we have those opening verses of Genesis to thank for that, and Adam and Eve to thank for that.
Let's take a short break right now. We'll have more with Bruce Feiler in a moment.
When Adam and Eve was in the Garden of Eden, they must have shook that thing. Well, the leaves started falling, the snake started crawling. He must have given her a diamond ring. Adam said to Eve, you just won't wait till I get out of this garden gate. When Adam and Eve was in the Garden of Eden, they must have shook that thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest on Two Way Street today is Bruce Feiler. He's had 6 consecutive books on the New York Times bestseller list, including Walking the Bible, which was turned into a PBS series that he hosted. Bruce also writes a column for the New York Times called This Life. His new book is The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. In this part of our conversation, we're going to talk about the Michelangelo paintings in the Sistine Chapel. If you can go online right now, you can see the paintings we're going to discuss on our website at gpb.org/TWS. Let's make a very fundamental point here. The story of Adam and Eve that has been passed down to us that we take as the important lesson is they're living in paradise. They've been told by God, you can partake in anything in this beautiful garden that I've created for you except the forbidden fruit. Eve is lured and tempted by a snake to eat the fruit. She gives it to Adam. They are cast out of paradise, out of the Garden of Eden. And we are to take from that, under the traditional teaching, that Eve was to blame. She tempted Adam, led to their downfall, and they went out in disgrace. And virtually your entire book is a refutation of that story.
So I think, first of all, it's such a pleasure to be with you and to have a thoughtful conversation about this. And let me just set the stage here. I think of the story as a modern Hollywood three-act movie. The act one is when they meet the meet-cute, and it ends in happiness, right? I mean, he looks at her. She's the one. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. I don't think I need to spell out the sexual arousal there. And the two of them are naked and no shame. So it's all happy in the very beginning. That's the first act. The third act is what happens after they leave Eden, which to me is the most interesting part that no one ever talks about, with the children and all the same. But the second act, where all the conflict is about this drama surrounding the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I think that what you said is fundamentally true. You've got them together, but Eve is bored. You know, she wants more. She wants independence. She goes off and she eats the fruit. Now, what is it? It's the fruit of the knowledge of the good and evil. It's knowledge, right? So she's seeking knowledge, independence, and that is central to, in effect, becoming human. And witness, she doesn't die, though she's told she's going to die. She doesn't die. And what happens is she's now alone. Milton, again, is great on this. Like, it will be a I can just keep the power for myself, right? It'll be a win for the female sex. That's what it is in Paradise Lost. And then she says, but so dear, I love Adam. You know, I want independence, but I want interdependence, back to what we were talking about earlier. She goes back. She offers it to Adam. He's got a choice, okay? So he knows the difference because God has said it to him. Does he pick duty or does he pick companionship and love? He also picks love. He eats too. So we now have the two of them affirmatively choosing each other, right? So they've been together. There's been this crisis, and they re-choose. I mean, that's why, to me, the number one lesson of this story is that love is not a choice we make once. It's a choice we make over and over again. And that's what the modern psychologists tell us. You have to be able to mend ruptures and heal wounds and be able to move forward. So they've chosen each other. They get cast out of Eden. But let's remember, at the last moment, again, an unknown moment, stop 100 people in the streets. How many people will know this? That right as they're cast out of Eden, God protects them with clothing and says, I'm going to continue to be with you. Let's remember his first commandment to them is be fruitful and multiply. He needs the story to succeed, and it does succeed.
Does he also need to continue having their companionship?
I think that he is alone.
Yeah,
he's
that's my
fundamentally
point.
If he
abandoned them, he's back to being alone himself.
Correct.
By
the way, in multiple times in the story with Abraham, with Moses, let's remember when Moses comes down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and the people have built the golden calf, God says to Moses, hey, why don't we just get rid of these people? You and I can start again. And it's Moses that says, no, we need to work it out with the people. So this idea of people straying and coming back is a consistent throughout the entire Hebrew Bible.
I think one of the observations you make that really fascinated me is you talk about up until the moment in which they are cast out of the garden. Organized religion has had a vertical orientation.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah.
Up to God. Yeah. We're down here. God is up there. Spiritual leaders are between us, whatever. But you point out that the fall was necessary. Because without the fall, we would have continued this vertical orientation, which would have prevented Adam and Eve from essentially being in a horizontal plane, relating to one another, and being able to therefore fall in love. And of course, you also point out, if it were not for that, Jesus would never have been born,
right,
and been necessary. That's a really interesting observation.
So, thank you. I think that I'm an experientialist, right? I grew up in South Georgia, and I think of myself as not an interesting person who's tried to go off and do interesting things, right? So my process is I'm an experientialist, I go off on experience, and I'm an explainaholic, I come back and explain them. So when I decide I want to write this book about Adam and Eve, like, well, where am I going to go, right? You know, the Garden of Eden is in Iraq, that's interesting, but there's no other place to go, right? So what happens is I discover this story of all these people around the world who've encountered this story. So I get to go on this road trip, right? So that's Michelangelo, that's Milton, that's Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, that's Mark Twain, that's Hemingway. That's the road trip I get to go on. And I'm the fool who's writing a book about religion, who decides to go to the Galapagos, right? And to go directly at Darwin, even though there's supposed to be this like epic battle between the evolutionists and the story of Adam and Eve, that Darwin is supposed to be responsible for killing Adam and Eve, and I decide to go at it. And there were a lot of times I thought, why am I doing this? Why I do it? Because, by the way, Darwin in the Galapagos says his favorite book while he's on the Beagle is Paradise Lost, and he carries it with him on the islands. And this idea that he's thinking of evolution while with Adam and Eve in his head is irresistible to me. It's because Darwin introduces the idea that we are compelled to pass along our genes, right? So that is a vertical passing down, and that's the whole idea of the selfish gene. Like, that's the only thing that we care about. But what Darwin realizes is that's not true, that there is this horizontal, this vertical need to pass it on. But there's this horizontal need, which is that we do things that are contradictory to that, which is we have relationships and we have family. Like, so that really suits not, that certainly doesn't suit the male. If he just wants to pass along his genes, he'd go find another female while the female was busy carrying his child and raising and weaning the child. But we have love because it is in the best interest of passing on those genes to have a family which will nurture those young people to fruition. Because human beings have something that no other animal species has, which is this 10-year period after we're weaned but before we can have children. It takes a long time to raise children to maturity. And so we have families and we have relationships. So that disrupts this vertical pass with this horizontal connection of love. And that's the book of Genesis. Why is it called Genesis? Because it's about the generations and it's about passing down. All the beginning, and we all laugh about it, but all the beginning and the generations and this generation, the whole story of Genesis is a vertical line of humanity. And yet Adam and Eve disrupt that because we are contradictory. We want to pass on our genes, but we also want a relationship. We want love. Love is in some ways at war with our own scientific selves, and that's what's interesting about it.
So as long as you bring up Darwin and the Galapagos, do you believe that Adam and Eve lived? Does it matter?
I think of the wisdom of a guy named Avraham Biran. I met him in his 90s. He was the dean of biblical archaeology, the first person to get a PhD in archaeology, who told me, you know, I don't know if Adam and Eve existed then, but I know they exist now.
What does that mean?
What that means is there is no evidence that any of the events in the five books of Moses, I've been doing this for 20 years, as you know, Bill, there's no evidence of Abraham or Moses or even David. There's just a smattering of evidence in it. There's actually more evidence about David coming out. So we have no evidence. We have no evidence that they didn't exist. So there's no evidence that they existed. I am interested in, but what I mean by it exists now is, there's evidence in the Sistine Chapel. There's evidence in Paradise Lost. There's evidence in Frankenstein. There's evidence in Mark Twain's beautiful writings about Adam and Eve for thousands of years, 30 centuries. That's 100 generations. People have encountered and talked about this story. That is very, very real, and that I know to be true. So I take the story profoundly seriously. And there's a scene with this archaeologist in the opening chapter of the first love story where he's talking about how it captures the transition from, you know, Paleolithic to Neolithic times. And I was like, wait a minute, you're an archaeologist. I would have thought you would have dismissed this story as a fairy tale. And he says, are you kidding? There were millions of stories in the ancient world, and there are dozens in the Bible. You know how good these stories had to be to make it into the Bible and how much wisdom they had to have? So I'm interested in that.
I want to talk, because it certainly plays a part in your awakening to an understanding of the importance of Eve. You've told us about the visit to the Vatican, to Sistine Chapel with your wife and daughters. But then as you really got into writing this book, you went back in a very different way. You tell us, for instance, that typically 2,000 people at a time get into the chapel. It's noisy. It's crowded. You can't really concentrate. But you had a very different experience. First, just how you saw the Sistine Chapel. I want to talk about that adventure and then talk about what you realized when you saw that painting.
So this is the kind of thing that I do that gets me in trouble, right? So I'm like, oh, I'm going to go back to Sistine Chapel. Well, I've already been a bunch of times. I want to go alone. Okay, well, there's only three ways to do that, right? You can be in a papal conclave, for which I'm not eligible. You can go in with the crowds and not sit down and talk. Or You can rent out the joint, it turns out.
I was shocked to learn that I could have a party.
You can have a private party. It's the modern indulgences, right? And so I met this guy who helps. The guy spends 60 grand. He flies in 60 friends. He puts them up in hotel rooms, and he's going to have his birthday party there. And the Vatican calls the morning and says, sorry, Porsche just called, and they're spending more money, so your party is canceled. So, okay, so I don't do that. So I start pulling strings and knocking on doors, and I pulled a little too hard, as you know, because it's in the book. I went twice in 12 hours. But when you go alone, so I go, I knock on the door of the Vatican Museum. We get pulled inside. You go up an elevator, four floors. You then go down through the empty halls with the carpets that my daughters didn't like. And then you go down this jetway, and my guide says, okay, now. And like, you're in the Sistine Chapel alone. The first thing you notice is the floor is interesting, right? It's like this marble floor. But the walls kind of, they pulse. There's so much intensity and art and history. It's almost like they're pushing in and out, like being in a living kaleidoscope or something. And it's very, I don't know, I think of it as like the reed of a medieval reed instrument, like the walls. The only other place I ever had that sensation was being in the Oval Office alone, actually, with President Bush, actually, who'd read my book on Abraham. And you feel like there's like history is watching you, right? And you're in this intense space. So, and it's a very interesting story. And the story basically is Michelangelo paints nine paintings down the spine.
He was commissioned initially, this is 1506, to do the apostles.
Right.
But he said, no, you want me to do the job, I'll do what I want, right?
Yeah, well, of course, we only have one version of it, his version.
And
his version, he's the hero.
All right.
So we don't know.
Okay.
But his version, he stands up to the Pope and says, I'm going to do what I want, and you stay out for 2 years. So that's fine. It's a better story. But we don't know. But I we'll go with that. So you've got three are the creation of the world. Three are the drunkenness of Noah. The drunkenness, by the way, right where the popes come out. And the middle three are of Adam and Eve. So the one that's most famous is the one we talked about earlier, Adam and God sailing across the ceiling, but that's not the one that Michelangelo thinks is the most famous. It's the next one. Remember, there's nine. The fifth one, the one that's the exact center, is not the creation of Adam. It's the creation of Eve. You have Adam lying to the left, God standing on the right, and Eve emerging, by the way, from Adam's side. Michelangelo knows his Bible, not the rib, and looking toward God. So the exact center is Eve. And go look at the image. I mean, she's sort of not exactly graceful, a little potato-y, but very powerful. Like
where is that in relation to the ceiling painting that we all know so well?
It's right next to it.
Okay,
so there's nine panels, and panel four is Adam and God with the fingers touching. Panel five is the one I've just described. Panel six is where they reach for the fruit. And by the way, it's not an apple. I mean, the Bible doesn't say. The Bible just says peri. It says fruit. The idea of apple comes because they read for 1,500 years, the church says you can only read the Bible in Latin. The Latin word for evil, as in the tree of good and evil, is malus, and the word for apple is malum. And so that's where the idea of apple, and that's where the idea of Adam's apple, right? Adam eats the apple and chokes on it, where the Adam's apple idea comes from. But the two are very intertwined, and they reach together. They clearly are partners. So in this story that I'm telling in the first love story, you've got organized religion dumping on Eve, as we've been talking about in this conversation, but you have this rival narrative of artists and thinkers and creative people, and the two are in conflict, and it's not really until the 20th century that they finally merge, because Michelangelo does more to elevate Eve than anybody had done in the first 2,000 years.
And that was a revelation for you, you tell us.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that, because I thought of that famous scene. It was absolutely a revelation.
You tell us the image that you thought mattered most was the fingers.
Yes.
The touching of Adam and God's fingers. And then suddenly, there you are, alone with your guide in the Sistine Chapel, and you see, no, this is the story of Eve. She is the most important figure here.
And I say to this African-American woman, Liz Lev, are they in love? And she says, well, depends on what you mean by love. Like, it's not the tingly Hollywood version of love, but it's we're made in God's image and God is love, so we are called to love each other.
One of these we'll do before we finish is I want to make sure that we have a chance to talk about what you think the lessons are for modern love out of what your research and thinking about this led you to. But before we get to that, I'm interested in the fact that, and I think it's through You talk about Elizabeth Cady Stanton later in the book. What probably the unsung
crazy good story, isn't it? Here's why I think this story matters. It's a, first of all, crazy interesting story. Eve, by the way, by all measures, is the primary actor in the story. She initiates most of the action and the crises and in some ways even the reconciliations that happen in the story of Adam and Eve. And yet for the first 2,800 years, men are the only people who speak publicly about the story. So the real change begins to occur when women can speak publicly. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony start the women's movement in the 1840s in Seneca Falls. I went to Seneca Falls, to her house in the upstate New York, as you know. And basically, Stanton was the brain power, but she had seven kids and a husband who was in Congress, and they were never together when they weren't making kids. And so basically, and Anthony was the public person. So Anthony was like, we need a speech. And Stanton would say, I'd like to write it, but I'm too busy. And Anthony would say, well, I'll take care of the kids and stir the pudding. You write the speech. And for 50 years, the two of them, they fight discrimination in law and voting and all this kind of stuff. And whenever they say women should vote, somebody would say, well, the Bible says women are secondary. Women should have property. The Bible says Eden is created from the rib. So she realized she has to rewrite the story, and she does. And she publishes a book called The Woman's Bible in 1895. It's a success. It goes back to the first story and says, look, they're created equally. It's a success, a landmark, and a disaster. She's kicked out of the movement that she begins. And so basically the most prominent woman in America takes on Adam and Eve and gets flattened. And the reason we don't think of Susan B. Anthony, that we think of Anthony and not Stanton, is because Stanton was forgotten for a century until the second wave of feminism. So it's an example of how powerful what I call the kind of the negative branding of Adam and Eve were. And it's not until modern women, so like Phyllis Trible, the Bible scholar, comes along in the 60s and says, well, why do we think Adam is superior? Because he's created first, her students say. And she says, well, the animals are created first, but they're not superior. So in the Bible, what's second is often first. Eve is not an afterthought. She's the culmination. And so they go, women go, and men too, rewrite the story. And so that now they have been re-equalized, which I think allows tease up where we're going to go next, which is, okay, now that we see them as equal, what can we learn from them?
Well, one of the things we learn, as you described for us, is that Adam and Eve went through many stages of their relationship. They dealt with crises and had to find a way to come back together, leaving Eden being just the first of a number of crises, having to cope together with the fact that one of their sons murders the other, another moment at which they have to find a way back together and have to recognize the power of their being together.
So lesson number one, what can we learn from Adam and Eve, is what you just say. It's resilience. It's constancy. It's stick-to-itiveness. They come together. They have a crisis with the fruit. They come back together. They leave Eden. They come back together. And this, they have two children. One murders the other. And what happens is there's a period of separation. If we were to do a poll of people listening to this conversation, does losing a child, you know, increase the chances that your relationship would fail? Most people would say yes. Turns out that's not true. And I talked to the woman who did the research, and it turns out that she followed 271 families who lost kids in Mount St. Helens. Only a dozen broke up in 25 years. What do they do? She told me they write a new chapter in their life story. I think of Alexander and Eliza Hamilton after they lose their son Philip. They're estranged, and in the musical Hamilton, that the best song to my ear is "It's Quiet Uptown." And what do? They take long walks. They go to the garden. They move, and they come together. And the last line of that song is "Forgiveness." Can you imagine? It takes an act of imaginativeness to get over the unimaginable. And that is the great lesson, the first great lesson, I think, that what Adam and Eve teach us, the power of resilience and forgiveness.
So while we're talking about that, what are the other important lessons that people who want to love each other consistently and for long periods of time, what did you learn in this?
So one, resilience, constancy.
Yep.
Number two, the balance you brought up earlier, this idea of a balance, of counterbalance, of the mix of independence and interdependence. We have Adam. Eve is created from Adam's rib, but Adam clings to her. Adam initiates the lovemaking after Eden that produces the children. Eve gives them their name. And after the death of Abel, when Cain is banished, when you look in Genesis 4, when they come together and have Seth, who goes on to populate the human line, it's like they're both weakened and they need each other. Like they have this child, God blesses them, but it's clear that they're propping each other up. And so this idea of balance, of equilibrium, of being a little bit selfless and a little bit selfish, right? It's that mix that I think is very powerful. But the number one thing I learned, Bill, as I said at the outset, I went in to write a book about Adam and Eve, and I wrote a book about love. And the number one thing that I learned is that love is a story we tell with another person. It's co-creation through co-narration. And the idea of joint storytelling, Piaget, the great child psychologist, and anyone who's had kids knows this. When young kids get together, they all sit in a room and they're playing with each other, but they're really talking only to themselves. He called that collective monologue. Like, love is the opposite. It's collective dialogue. It's the idea that each of us has our own story, but on top of it, we have the second story. I call it a two-story, the story you tell with another person. And it's this idea in that story, you're two protagonists, two people whose needs need to be fulfilled, whose fears have to be overcome. And it's that sense of joint storytelling that I think is the thing that I took most away, that when you hit a bumping road or you have a joyful moment or an upsetting moment or a disappointing moment or a fearful moment, you have to reach across the aisle, so to speak, to put it in the terms of the politics you spent much of your life studying, and tell a story with another person.
We're going to take another break right now. We'll continue my conversation with Bruce Feiler in a moment. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Let's get back to my conversation with New York Times bestselling author Bruce Feiler. You, how long have you and your wife been married?
It'll be 14 years this
okay.
summer.
You went through a crisis health.
A medical crisis when I had cancer in 2008, among other things. Yeah.
So there's a moment where two people have to find a way to be together and stay strong. You needed her. To stay strong for you, I assume. But what, as you researched this book and as you thought so deeply, as you obviously have, about Adam and Eve, how did that help you think about your marriage? Did it give you any new thoughts about your marriage? Or were you able to read it and say, thank goodness, we have this kind of marriage already?
Well, I think, what you brought up, the fact that I got cancer in 2008, I'm healthy and well now, fortunately. But one of the things I learned from that is that we think of life as a linear narrative, but in fact, the way we live our lives now is alinear, right? I got cancer at 43, right? It's not supposed to happen that way. People lose jobs or confront with illness or the death of a family member or losing a job or whatever it might be. We live our lives out of order, not the sort of, in my teens I do this, in my 20s I do that, in my 40s do that. That's the way we think of it. And this idea of an oscillating life narrative is very powerful. But in terms of what I learned for myself, I was a land person, right? The whole idea of walking the Bible is, let's bring the land back into the conversation. Like, the story of the Bible is about the God, the people, and the land. And if we take the land out, we miss the big point. This has taught me a different way of looking at the Bible, and that there's not just promised land in the Bible, there's also promised love in the Bible. And that this story, it's almost like the success goes to, the default is success. Years ago, I've never told this story publicly. Years ago, we got married, and then some friends of ours were on the fence about whether to get married, and they took us out right after, my wife Linda and I. And we were living in Manhattan at the time, and they said, well, what's the biggest difference between being married and not married? And I just said instinctually, without even thinking about it, that the default switch is set to success, not failure, right? Every little thing doesn't become an, when you're dating, every little thing becomes an existential crisis, right? Should we be together or should you not? When you're married, it sort of becomes something to supplant. So to me, it's just a reminder, and I think one of the reasons that I think this story matters and that I'm passionate about the first love story in Adam and Eve, is that they are our foundational story. This story has been at the basis of our civilization for 3,000 years, and it matters that our default be set to success, not failure, because in this age where relationships have become, you know, commodified, right? Real Housewives and, you know, tabloids and celebrities are who we look to be our heroes. Those are all failure stories, right? And it matters that our first story be a success so I can look at my children and say, okay, look, you have promised love. Like, this is going to work. And by the way, it ain't that fantasy Hollywood love story where it's you meet and it's love happily ever after. It's a series of choices. It's a series of hardships. But that's, we've been defining love wrong. We've been defining it as something that's effervescent and spectacular, and then when it evaporates, we're shocked. That's not what love is. Love is not, you don't shut the novel after the second chapter. It's a long journey, and that's what kind of keeps me stable, and that's certainly what I want to tell my daughter.
You know, here's one of the things that occurred to me that I'd never thought about until I read your book. And I could only come to this point because you've said to me, rethink the fall from grace. Mm. Think of it differently. Mm. So I thought about the fact when Eve tells Adam, eat of this fruit, and he knows he's not supposed to, he takes it. He eats it. Mm. One of the reasons he eats it is he trusts her. He doesn't think she is there to do him wrong. It doesn't occur to him that she's asking him to do something out of malice in her heart. Mm. And it strikes me that that's one of the most important keys to being able to work in a successful relationship, is that even when you're at odds with one another, mm-hmm. you accept mm. that your partner is not there to be doing you harm. It's just a disagreement. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Oh, I think it's beautiful. I like the sense of trust. I mean, that's it's a beautiful image. They choose each other. And that the original moment when God has created Eve and Adam falls in love, right? You know, it's exactly what, you know, what the modern scientists tell us, that guys will fall in love with anything, right? The second he sees her, he's like, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Like, I'm happy. I'm going to, you know, whatever. I'm aroused, right? But that's not a love moment. That's a lust moment, if you will. This moment where they both know that there's some consequence and they still choose it. And let's be clear, God needs them to succeed.
Yes.
And they have to choose each other. And part of it is they have to separate themselves from him in order to fulfill their destiny. And what happens in that moment when she eats and then she gives it to him, he eats? What happens in that moment? They open their eyes and they realize they're naked and they feel shame. Shame, not guilt. What is the difference? Guilt is internal. Shame is external. It's almost like the eyes of the world are on them. And who are the eyes of the world? That's the civilization that they will give birth to. So it's the first moment that they basically make this transition away from being exclusively God's children in paradise toward being the progenitors of humanity that's to come.
I love that. There are people who may read your book who are alone. Hmm. And I wonder if you think about what that means. Hmm. This entire book is about the rapturous joy of love and how powerful it is in life. So how should people who may not have that read your book, and what can they do with that?
First of all, I have thought about this, and the book is about the danger of loneliness and the power of connectedness as an antidote to loneliness. So this story happens to be about romantic love and procreation because we're getting the Bible going, and therefore we need to have humanity. And it doesn't say the only kind of love is male or female love. It doesn't say that the only kind of antidote to loneliness is romantic love. So there's lots of human connection, relations to family members, to neighbors, to colleagues at work, whatever it might be. I mean, to me, that's the sort of, you know, we were just talking about Adam and Eve eating the fruit, and what do? They open their eyes, right? That eyes are such a connection. And I became friendly over the years with a now early deceased professor at Stanford, whose name was Cliff Nass, who talked to me about the power of face-to-face communication. And especially in our digital age where we're all looking into screens all the time, we're losing this ability. We know the young people, that's overwhelming for them, right? Why do young people like have group dates and hook up? Because one-on-one eye contact, as you and I are doing, is overstimulating. Put down your screen, walk outside, talk to your neighbor, make a human connection. That is the answer to aloneness. And there is nothing in this story that says that the only way to be connected is to be connected to a romantic partner.
You say something else as you are coming to the end of your book that is really powerful for me that I hadn't realized. There's no mention of Eve ever dying.
Oh, my God. I'm so glad you brought this up. You're the first person. I've done a number of interviews about this book in some very high-profile places. You're the first person to bring up this incredibly central point.
It's remarkable. What does it mean to you?
I interviewed Jonathan Sacks, who's the greatest rabbi on the planet, and one of my favorite writers about religion. And he was so, generous to give me time for him. And he's sort of one of my own little conclave of love at the end, as you know. And I said, Rabbi, what do we make of the fact that Adam dies and that Eve doesn't die? And he's like, I never thought about it. I'm like, what do you mean? Come on, this is huge. Like, she gets this honorific of eternal life, you know? And then, and in fact, when I wrote that in my book and I turned it into my editor was like, oh, come on, you're making too much of this, Filer. Like, you know, it's just another way that Eve was dumped. I'm like, are you kidding? All the Sarah, Rebecca,
the Hebrew
Rachel,
Bible is filled with
women
she
dying.
Died.
Yes.
Yeah.
Eve is the only person who doesn't die. So I think of her as being around to rewrite the narrative and to sort of to be the antidote, the counter voice to the negative voice that organized religion is doing in her name. So as long as she is alive, as long as she never dies, their love never dies. And to me, she's a testament to the power of the relationship. And finally, she has lived, so to speak, to see her name reconciled.
As we come to a conclusion, I do love the fact that you include Mark Twain in your book. Mark
so
Twain,
good.
You tell us,
so good.
Was fascinated with the story of Adam and particularly about Adam, about both of them. Do you mind if I read a quote from your book?
Please read this quote. I know what you're going to read. It's amazing.
He wrote about them more
five
than
or six
once.
Books. Yeah, five or six books. Yeah. Unknown, The Diaries of Adam and Eve. He wants Adam to replace. He writes to the organizers of the Statue of Liberty and say, replace the Statue of Liberty with a statue to Adam. He's in Jerusalem on Innocence Abroad when he first encounters it, and then he writes, which I know. I just know
he
exactly
says,
what you're going to read.
Blessed be the sorrow that brought us near together and taught me to know the goodness of her heart and the sweetness of her spirit. And she says, I love him with all the strength of my passionate nature. It is my prayer, it is my longing that we shall pass from this life together. Then Adam says, wheresoever she was, there was Eden. What a wonderful way to end our conversation, because that's really what it's all about for you in this book, Bruce Filer, is two people coming together and finding love and fulfillment, and learning all of it from the story of the very first love of Adam and Eve. Thank you so much for being here today. It was a really joyous experience to get to talk to you, Bruce.
What an honor.
You can learn more about Bruce Filer, his books, and watch a couple of video clips from his PBS series, Walking the Bible, on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS, or on our Facebook page. We'll also post a link to Bruce's New York Times column, This Life. Before we leave you today, I want to remind you that if you can't be near a radio when we're on the air, you can listen to the show on your own schedule by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also find our shows archived on the Two Way Street website. And, of course, we're on Facebook, too. If you visit our page, please like us while you're there. I also want to remind you that if you're as fascinated by the political landscape today as we are, you may want to check out our other show on GPB Radio, Political Rewind. We're live Mondays and Wednesdays at 2 and Fridays at 3. We talk politics with some of the smartest political analysts and insiders in the business. Two-Way Street senior producer is the astonishingly affable Jenny Ament, who also edited today's show. Our producer is the admirably adroit Lisa Clark, and our audio engineer is the appealingly acoustical Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening today. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.